How do we move students' thinking forward in a way that's meaningful, inclusive, and still hits all the demands of teaching math? I had an opportunity to chat about all of this and so much more with today's guest, Graham Fletcher. Graham is a former classroom teacher and instructional lead and is currently a math specialist. He is the co-author of Building Fact Fluency and shares so many fantastic resources on his website. In this episode, we dive into everything from choosing rich tasks that provide multiple entry points to the art of assessing where students are within a learning progression. We also talk about balancing conceptual understanding with the pressure put on us by pacing guides. This conversation is full of actionable ideas to move students' thinking forward. Let's get to the interview. Graham Fletcher, welcome to the Mix and Math podcast. I'm so glad that you are here.
I'm stoked to be here. We've had lots of time to chat in person and sort of kind of make our private conversations public, I guess, because we both love the same thing, right? So just supporting kids. Just thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, so I'm going to kick it off with anytime I am, you know, I like to be very prepared. And so anytime I'm preparing for a podcast interview, I like to listen to a bunch of other podcasts that you've been on. You said this quote and I was like, oh my gosh, I've got to ask Graham about it. You said, are you a teacher who learns math to solve problems, or are you a teacher who solves problems to learn math? Can you explain that to us a little bit? Because I think it's going to frame our conversation a lot today.
Yeah, it's for me, it's two fundamentally different approaches to math instruction. But it's such a simple play on words. So if we think about that first line, do you learn math to solve problems? What that's basically saying is, I want to teach you how to do all the math, and then you're going to go do the problem solving. Where the second line says is, we want to teach problems, and that's going to help us learn math. And I always think about Dan Meyer, when he talks about he created three-act tasks when they first came out back in 2013. He talks about this analogy of headaches and aspirin. And if we think about the aspirin is the math that we're teaching, and then the headache is the actual problem. Well, in that first sentence, it says, do you teach math to learn problems, or do you learn math to tackle problems? And what you're doing is you're giving kids aspirin before they even know that they have a headache. And I think that's typically how so many of us were taught, right? It's, if we go back to the old textbooks, it's like do questions 1 through 30 in the textbook, learn how to do the math, and then solve the word problems at the bottom of the page on the textbook. Yeah. But I think where I think you and I really come together and align is we're like, let me give you a really pithy problem, a really rich problem. And then from this problem, we've created a headache for you. And then now you want to learn the math. And I think that's the approach that's, I really truly believe in. And I know you kind of see eye to eye on that as well, but that's it. Do you want to teach kids the math first and then they go problem solve? Or do you want to give them the problem solving and then an outcome of the problem solving is the math that we learn?
Yeah. And so it's really interesting. That is kind of a controversial perspective, which is a little bit shocking to me. Like I don't maybe see why we wouldn't want to teach math in this way, but do you have any insight or maybe like, I know you work with a lot of teachers who may be a big shift for them. Do you have any insight into why teaching math in this way is more effective for students?
I think because I'll quote James Hibbert, who wrote a book called Making Sense. And he talks about this thing called math residue. And when we think of this word residue, right, like residue, something that's sticky. And so what happens is when we're just teaching a bunch of math in isolated concepts, there's nothing that really sticks, right? So what happens is it only ever stays in short-term working memory and never gets moved to long-term memory. So if we think about this idea of building and leaving math residue, well, I want to take a really good task. And if I use a really good task to begin, what happens is now I can always talk about the future learning on that task that we've used, as opposed to saving the really good task for the end of the unit. I want to use that task at the beginning of the unit. And then everything that comes out, I can always come back and say, oh, remember when we did that task? Remember when we did that task? But if we save that task for the end of the unit, then it's summative assessment. And I think we all kind of know how summative assessment doesn't really help us so much as classroom teachers.
Yeah, that is such a good point. And actually, you know, it's really interesting. That's probably not the answer I thought you were going to give, but that's such a powerful answer because there is this activity that I absolutely love, and it's having students make their own rulers. And a lot of times that's done like in lower grades, right? To have students, you know, help them understand, you know, just measuring length and understanding what a ruler is and how it functions. But I actually love doing that in upper elementary as well, because we constantly are going back to, we have them measure with rulers with different units. So like one student's measuring with a ruler with big units and another student's measuring with a ruler with small units. And they do that early on to understand this idea of, you know, why when we measure with a smaller unit, we get a larger measurement and so forth. And it's that activity that we are constantly referring back to. Remember when they get answers that are unreasonable, we're constantly referring back to that experience. And so I love this idea that doing these rich tasks at the beginning kind of provides this shared experience. They're, you know, kind of, you're creating like the foundations of that understanding, and you get to use that constantly. You're constantly referring back to That's really interesting. I love that. And I think that that's a really good, like that would convince me to be like, okay, we need to do these tasks earlier on.
Like, I think for us as teachers, right? Like any teacher, like we get bombarded with these three terms: formative, diagnostic, and summative assessment. So if we think about this approach, right? So if we go to the way that traditionally we approach math, if we save that really, really good task for the end of the unit, it becomes summative assessment. And for me as a classroom teacher, summative assessment doesn't help me. It's great for administrators, coaches, but it doesn't, because what happens is if we save it for the end of the unit, like on a Friday, because we all like to finish a unit on a Friday, we like that nice, neat, clean tidiness part of it. But what happens is then I grade that task over the weekend, and I realize that half my kids still can't do the skill that I thought that they were going to be able to do. So I make a big long list of kids that I need to remediate with on Monday, but I can't because my district pacing guide says that geometry starts. And so I get caught up there. So what I would much rather do is if I take that task and I put it at the beginning of a unit, fishing for that trying to make that math residue happen, is it becomes formative and diagnostic assessment. And if on day one in a fourth grade class, we're doing a division task, you get a kid who goes ahead and you get a student who basically draws out a bunch of circles and counts by ones. I want to catch that on day one of a unit. But if that same student is using the same strategy that I identified on day one at the end of the unit, that for me is no longer that student's issue. That's a me issue, because I haven't been intentional enough about leveraging that task as formative and diagnostic to move their thinking through a progression of learning. So I think task placement, and so that we can always go back and leverage it, is a really pivotal shift in terms of how we approach math instruction, for sure.
Yeah. And I want to come back to this idea about progressions, because that's something else that you and I both have like a nerdy passion around.
Absolutely.
But you said something around the fact, you know, moving this to the beginning, moving these tasks to the beginning as diagnostic and formative. And I think it can feel really scary as a teacher to go into, to give students this task and be like, but I haven't taught this yet. Like, how are they going to, like, I'm not supporting them if I'm just giving them this task. Like, what would you say to that teacher who has those reservations around moving that task, you know, before they've officially taught the math inside it?
So I think one of the things, I love task creation. Like when I think about my happy spot, I love creating tasks. But one of the toughest things that I have to do, and I, to be honest, I really hate doing it, is assigning a grade level to a task. Mm-hmm. Because one task, like I could give a group of third grade students a task. I could see kindergarten thinking in that task. I could see first grade. I could see fifth grade thinking. So for me in that moment is it becomes, and I think we've kind of all heard this idea of low floor, high ceiling. So for me, it's more about task selection. So it's not that I haven't taught it to students yet, because I'm going to get there eventually, but how open is that task for students? Does it have multiple entry points? And if a student's drawing all, counting all, when they're multiplying 2x2 digit numbers in fourth grade, great. Like, I'd rather catch that at the beginning part of the unit, but a good task will give them that entry point to where at least they could draw all, count all. And so for me, tasks, when we see a task that's a specific grade level, I take that for what it's worth, because if you teach fourth grade, you don't teach fourth grade. What you teach are 10-year-olds who function at a kindergarten through seventh grade level. And your job is to move all of their thinking forward. So for me, really rich tasks are what invite all students to the mathematical sandbox. And I think that's the part. Like, it's okay if a kid's drawing all, counting all, but are we using the task intentionally to move their thinking forward and identify where their thinking is?
Yeah. Okay. So how, and this is probably a really loaded question, I'm like, I don't know how we talk about this in a 30-minute podcast, but how do you move all students thinking forward when you have this open task and you have got students that are on in a variety of places of understanding? What does it look like to move every student's thinking forward?
Well, I don't think that you'd be able to do it just in one day. And so when you use that really rich task at the beginning of that unit, you're grouping kids heterogeneously. And it's an idea I got from the Shell Project MAP, an assessment in England. They've done a really good job just looking at assessments. And what they state is, when you're working with your students, you want to group them heterogeneously when you're using a really good task. Then when you find out that you have a group of students who are drawing all, counting all, you have a group of students who could maybe do tens and ones, you have some students who can use partial products, some students who can do the standard algorithm, then you group the students homogeneously based off of where their thinking is within that progression. Then you're moving them to that next stage. So maybe you might have students that do counting strategies. Then you'd have kids who use additive strategies, multiplicative strategies. And then when you're grouping them homogeneously based off of what you learned from that task, you're trying to move them to that next stage. Then you'd use a new task, see if they can apply that understanding in maybe like a week or 10 days. And then you would do the regrouping again. So your groups are very liquid. They're in and out, very malleable. But I think it's that piece. You're not going to keep them heterogeneously all the time. You can be able to flexibly group homogeneously once you identify where their thinking is.
Yeah, I love that. And I really appreciate that you said that, because I think sometimes we can hear things in math education and think that it is either this or it is that. And I think there's a lot of talk around heterogeneous grouping, and there needs to be a lot of talk around that, because I think maybe we're not seeing those heterogeneous groups enough, but that doesn't mean that we are never grouping students homogeneously. Like, there is a time and a place for that. And it's a really intentional decision as to when we group students in that way. So
that's it. Yeah. And I think that's it. We're not saying, because it's like two totally different dichotomies. We need to do whole group, and then teachers are running around like a chicken with their head cut off, trying to like differentiate for every single student in the class. And that is a daunting task for anybody. But then also, if we only ever do homogeneously and we only ever do small groups, then we start tracking students and we're putting them in silos. So we just start moving them in groups. I think we have to be intentional, exactly what you said, Brittany. We have to be intentional about when we're doing heterogeneously, when we're doing homogeneously. I find that as I continue to improve my craft as a teacher, I'm now more able to do homogeneous grouping within a heterogeneous setting. So I can start pulling in, if I see two or three kids thinking similarly, I can pull them together within that heterogeneous setting and then move their thinking forward. And then we go back to that whole class.
Yeah, I love that. A term that I heard Julie Dixon say, and I don't remember, it must've been in a podcast interview or something, because I was frantically trying to go figure out where she said this, but she said, she used the term moderately heterogeneous grouping. And I loved that, because it also kind of, it gives us this like in between of, it's maybe not exactly what you're saying, but it's close to what you're saying, is we are in this heterogeneous grouping and we find these students who have these similarities that we want to support or address in a certain way. And so that, I loved that term. I've hung on to that moderately heterogeneous grouping.
Well, I guess since we're talking about Julie Dixon, not behind her back, with this being public, of course.
We love her.
Right. She said something that lives rent-free in my head, and it's that differentiation should be just in time, not just in case. So yes. I think that falls beautifully in line with what you're like, with the quote that she shared with you, that's kind of resonating with you. It's just because we're differentiated doesn't mean that we always have to do things one set way. That flexibility, right? And I think for us as teachers, that's hard because a lot of the times we want to be compliant. We don't, like, just tell me to do homogeneously grouping. Just tell me to do heterogeneous. But I think it's more of a commitment. There's compliance versus commitment. Are we committed to moving students' thinking forward? All of us are. I think that's why we love what we do. So I think it's how do we become committed to this malleable, flexible grouping.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to shift us a little bit to progressions because we keep talking about moving students' thinking forward. And I think that we're just like teetering the discussion of the progressions, which is something we both love. So you have these progression videos, which would you say that those are like the thing that you're known for across the internet? Are your progression?
Itzos, yeah, probably those. And then also the tasks. But yeah. I find that like we're in that space to where like some people might say, hey, Graham, can you talk about tasks or can you talk about progressions? And here I am. I can't talk about those two things homogeneously. I need to talk about them heterogeneously because
exactly.
They're so intertwined, right? Like they're so connected and I can't see them as so granular.
Yes. So we're going to provide space for both because we're going to come back to tasks because just like you said, when we start, like the progression really helps us with task selection, but let's talk about these progressions. So you have these progression videos that really show how understanding builds across, you know, grade levels within, you know, different domains or different concepts. And, you know, I've heard you talk a lot about like, we want to move students thinking forward in a, you know, within a class, not in a class period, but we want to move students thinking forward, right?
Right.
And obviously we're moving them forward across this progression. And I think where some teachers can feel overwhelmed is what do we do when we are aware of this progression? And now we have students and we're like, okay, I know that some students are here in the progression and other students are here in the progression and other students are here in the progression. Where do they go from there? Is that kind of exactly what you're saying with this homogeneous and heterogeneous grouping, or you know what would be your recommendation to the teacher who's using those progressions? They're aware of where their students are at, and now they're like, now what? Now what do I do?
Yeah, so I think that for me is where the work of the five practices really come in, where we talk about anticipating, monitoring, selecting, sequencing, and connecting. How trying to find out, I think what ends up happening is when we look at student thinking, we look at it as such a granular bite-sized piece. So say you're a second grade teacher and you've got 28 kids in your class. Well, when you're walking and I'm walking around the room, we're looking at every single individual student on an individualized basis. And that becomes daunting when I start thinking of it at such a granular bite-sized piece. So instead, with that idea of the five practices, I love the idea of if you were to zoom out and look at all the classroom work that's taken place from one task, if you were to put that into a progression, and I'll never say the words high kids and low kids, like I wouldn't use that in a parent-teacher conference. What I'll say is right. Students who are earlier in their thinking mm-hmm. and students who are farther along in their thinking, with every student being on that progression. So maybe a challenge to those who are listening to the podcast is next time you do a really good task is at the end of the day, what happens if you collect all that work and you put it on your back kidney table and you put it into a progression? And what you'll find is you basically just built a roadmap for how to move student thinking forward. And then when you look at the progression and you look at your student work, that gives you actionable steps of how to move that student thinking forward, as opposed to just saying, I got a kid who's drawing all counting in fourth grade. I got to get them to multiply 2 by 2. That seems daunting because there's a lot of steps that's happening in between there, and trying to make those connections between the class and the class's thinking makes it much more attainable and not as overwhelming. It's still daunting. But the more that we can think about this through the lens of a progression, the more efficient we become at it.
Yeah. And so I think that is why progressions are so powerful. And goodness, I should remember this name. Maybe you'll know it. It was when I was getting my master's, there was this author. He wrote the book, or I don't know if it's a book. It's a something in between like a book and an article. It's bigger than an article, smaller than a book.
Okay.
But he wrote, it was assessment for learning rather than assessment of learning. I was reading this and there was this quote and it really, I feel like completely changed my teaching practice. He said, Rarely is it that students go from not understanding to all of a sudden understanding. Like every student is on a journey to understanding, and like our goal is to figure out where they are in that process. And the reason this was such a huge shift for me is because how often, I know for me, in my own experience, it would be like, okay, I'm teaching this concept and I'm just pulling all of the activities that relate to that concept. And then when I had this shift, I realized that understanding this progression allowed me to be really intentional with how I ordered the tasks that I chose, because I realized that, you know, different tasks were, granted, you know, they're high, low floor, high ceiling. And so they can kind of fit in different places, but some are more, are just more appropriate for different places in that journey or in that progression. That was huge for me. And it really kind of, I think, set me on this journey of exploring progressions. And I think it gets at what you were saying with task selection, like understanding the progression helps us really decide on tasks. Has that been your experience and how you use the progressions to some extent?
Absolutely. So there's different levels of complexity within tasks. So as we go through that progression, we can begin to increase the complexity of it as well. Just like the math itself increases in complexity as we work through the grade, as we work through that progression. So yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think one of the things I was thinking about is where like I've got this kid here and I need to get them here and it's just supposed to happen automatically. Well, we've all boiled water on our stove. When you turn on that stove, nothing's happening.
For a good 10 minutes.
Right. Like nothing. Like you don't even see a bubble. And then all of a sudden you start seeing one and two little bit of bubbles. Now you didn't turn it off and keep firing up and try something new, putting it on a different burner. You knew that it was going there because you knew that it was going to take time to get through that certain stages of heating up that water. But so often in a math class, we turn on the stove and we want to see the boiling water right away. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the tough part. So the more I think that we can empower ourselves and build our own capacity and our own knowledge, which is hard because we're being asked to teach a subject completely different than how many of us were taught it ourselves. But when we go through that, it's when you understand the math and the progressions, you're more willing to step back and let that thinking boil in the classroom, as opposed to keep throwing more fire on it. More fire isn't going to make the water any hotter.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. And I think this is where it becomes really challenging. So I have like two thoughts. One, it takes a lot of trust to know that the water will eventually boil. Like sometimes when it's not boiling and you're not seeing any action, it's like, am I doing the right thing? When flip side is, I think sometimes teaching, teaching how we were taught, teaching the algorithms, teaching the memorizing the steps and all of that sometimes gives us that like boiling water feeling much sooner. We see little hints of like, okay, they can get an answer, so we're good. Even though we know deep in our hearts that that is not producing understanding that lasts. And so I think that we have to acknowledge the fact that it's really, especially for teachers, maybe who aren't quite bought in on teaching for understanding yet, or teaching, you know, focusing on conceptual understanding, that we have to trust the process a little bit, and we may not get that false, like, the false, I can do it right away that we would if we weren't teaching in this way. Do you see that in
100%
your work?
Yeah, we get, I think all of us collectively, right? We get a lot of false positives that kids have an understanding that they don't. Mm-hmm. But what they're able to do is they're able to mimic, where it stays mm-hmm. in short-term working memory and never gets moved to long-term memory. To where, let me teach you this strategy for 3 days, and then we hit Friday, and then you come back on Monday, and the kids have completely forgot everything that you taught them last week. But that's because it only ever stays in short-term working memory. So for me, it's going to take longer to go back. It's going to take longer to move it to long-term memory. But I think about how many of us are like freaking out when we get to April mm-hmm. because we have to go back and reteach everything that we taught in August and September, depending on where your school year starts. But yeah, and so that idea of a false positive, we get a lot of them for sure.
Yeah, and so how do, I know that you are working with, teachers in different schools. And so I think sometimes we can feel really stuck within a pacing guide when we know students need a little bit more time. And so how do we navigate that? Like, how do we balance this need, this maybe feeling like we need to rush through it, but knowing that students need a little bit more time? And then also, this is like terrible podcast etiquette to ask a follow-up question before I've given you the chance to answer the first one, is also then, how do we know when to move on when we know that students need time?
Yeah. So two really pithy questions. So I think about this. Pacing guides do hamstring us a lot. But if you think about it, any resource, no matter what district you're in, what state you're in, what province, if you're listening to it in Canada, I think about there's 180 days worth of lessons in at least 180 days worth of lessons in every resource. I have never in my 23 years of education met a teacher who's taught 180 days worth of math. So you're right, already going to miss the mark in terms of your pacing guide. Knowing that pacing guides are there as kind of a checklist. And so like, let's keep moving. What I find is that the more that I understand the content, I can now zoom back out and look at where maybe a resource has broken things down so granularly so that they could have 2 weeks worth of content that I could compress into like 2 days worth of work. I think rounding in third grade is one of the things that just really gets at me. Like, we spend like a whole month on rounding, and at the end of that first month of rounding, nobody ever has rounding down pat. So then we get into October, November, and we're still rounding for mastery. So that's one of those ideas that I know that I'm going to need to go back and revisit rounding throughout the year. And I can do that through estimation. And so I think that's one of those big things. Pacing guides are there. But how can we zoom back out and look at the granular from a lesson by lesson by lesson and maybe combine some of those that would free us up and give us more time for the conceptual understanding? Like, I'm thinking about regrouping with subtraction in second grade. Second grade teachers could start that in September and still be teaching it in May. Like, that is the thorn in their side. But there's other things in second grade that we could combine that would give us more time. So I think when we start thinking and planning as units, or we start thinking and planning as a school year, where are we going to get the most bang for our buck of where we need to have this solid understanding? And we can pull in those other ideas along the way that might not be macro standards, but more so micro standards.
Yeah, that is fantastic, because essentially what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, essentially what you're saying is, you know, sometimes we are like zoomed in so closely, like lessons in a curriculum can be zoomed in so closely on, maybe it's like, we're using this specific model this day. And you're saying, rather than, you know, when, especially when we're trying to find time, we are now zooming out and thinking about, okay, what is like the key understanding here? Are there several lessons, or is there a task that could cover several of, you know, these lesson goals in one, to kind of give us more time to spend on other things?
Yeah. I think one of the best examples that I've been able to kind of wrap my head around here over the last maybe 2 years is counting collections. And so, huge fan of counting collections. But I think what happens is we're like, well, I don't have time to spend on counting because I have to get into the operations, right? Like, operations sounds way more complex than what counting is. Mm-hmm. But I think that we can infuse them all in together to where maybe we give kids in second grade a bag of counters and we're like, estimate how many were in there, count them. Well, what was the difference between your actual and your estimate? What's your closest 10? What's your closest 100? How many more do you need to get to 1,000? So now we can pull in things that are granular based in like 6 different units and pull them all into one really rich routine that we could be doing once a week. So we're revisiting and reviewing things that we've already tackled. We're setting up things to where we're going to be going with the operations. And it's that idea of trying to combine different ideas and mathematical concepts, which allow for a spiraling to take place, which then moves it from short-term working memory to long-term memory, because we leave it. And when we come back, we have to retrieve it. And that's what pushes it from short-term working memory to long-term memory. But that's just one example with counting collections. But there's a lot of other places to where that can happen.
Yeah. And you're making so many connections with those counting collections too. You're connecting so many different concepts, which, you know, we know cements that learning as well. So that's awesome. Are there any other routines that you're loving right now outside of counting collections?
I'm a huge fan of choral counting. That's another one. But it's not like I'm not doing round robin counting, because I still remember this to this day when we were learning our third grade multiplication facts. And well, I said third grade already, so I'm just repeating the third grade part of that. and so what we do is like we kind of go around the room and we'd say the fact, and then when it got to me, I'd be like, oh, I made it. And then as it goes all the way around the room again, the anxiety is just building. And then I'd say that number and I was like, ugh. But where choral counting is because you're seeing patterns in numbers, that's what gives kids more access to those numbers. There's multiple. You might, in a class of 28, you might have five kids that know the top row of your choral count. But when they start seeing the pattern, that invites kids to see it. Then you can
have tell kids, us what choral counting is? Because I think there are probably going to be some teachers who haven't heard of choral counting.
Yeah, for sure. So what choral counting is we're normally like, we'd say like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, like you just go ahead and count. Well, as a first and second grade teacher, you've probably gone ahead and said or heard yourself like, my kids can't count by tens when they're not on the decade. And so what we would do is we'd say, all right, class, today what we're going to do is we're going to count by tens. We're going to start at 12. And then so we'd go 12, 22, 32, 42, 52, and then I'd start a new line. And then I'd go 62, 72. And in doing those choral counts, now when we've got a series of numbers rowed in rows, patterns are going to start screaming at kids. They're going to be like, wait a minute, like every row goes up 50. Why does every row go up 50? Well, because we're counting by 10 five times. So if you go diagonal, it's going to go 60. Why does it go 60? Well, because it's 50 plus one more. So now, and then you can make predictions at the bottom of it. What would be the number in the next row, in the next three rows? So choral counting and counting collections. I'm a huge fan of the book. There's a book that would be, it's probably one of the books that's really helped me over the last 6, 7 years in terms of a game changer, just because we can do this with whole numbers. We can do it with fractions, decimals, integers if you're in middle school. So the scalability of this routine is you really get a lot of bang for your buck.
Yeah. And I think this goes back to, because I can sense the like, oh, but I already don't have enough time in the classroom. But this goes back to exactly what you were saying of we are addressing so many different things in this routine that it's worth making space for.
Absolutely. Like if you don't have time to not find the time to make the time, like that's, you're getting a lot out of that. So maybe you do a counting collection for one day a week, and then you do a choral count the other day of a week. And then maybe you do a number talk on another day of the week. And those, all of those routines are scalable in the numbers that we play with students, but then it's scalable vertically by grade level. But then also if we look at it through the consistency of a school year, it also goes through domains as well. So yeah, great, great bang for your buck with those two routines.
Yeah. And we'll link, did you mention the name of the book that you were?
Yeah, it's called Choral Counting and Counting Collections. So okay, I'll send you the link. And
okay,
so,
perfect.
Yeah, if coaches that listen to the podcast, this is great to get this. This would be a great school-wide initiative. Berkeley Everett does some amazing work with choral counting and counting collections. And, you know, you check out his website and the work that he's done there. He shares a lot of the work that the teachers he supports, he does.
So that's awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely get all of that linked down below. Okay, you have got the progressions on your site. You've got the 3-act tasks on your site. You also have a fantastic fluency kit that we've not even talked about. You did that with Tracy Zager. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. First off, I don't know how you have time for all of this, but where did your like passion for fluency and just this decision to create this kit, like where was that born for you?
Through a classroom. So it's actually a story that it just resonates with me. I love number talks. And I think many of us who have been teaching longer than 5 years, We see that proliferation of number talks, right? Like it's been sold as kind of like the holy grail to get kids to the promised land of fluency. And so what I realized is I was in a first grade class and I love number talk. So let me just go ahead and throw that full disclosure out there. I've leaned on both the Blue Book and the Green Book from Sherry Parrish and also Ruth Parker's book, Number Talks Matter. Uh-huh. And so I was in a first grade class. And if you're not familiar with what a number talk is, it's where you get a series of expressions. So like you might get like 10 plus six and kids are going to say 16. Then you'd have 9 plus 6. And that's going to force them to kind of like make a 10. So we were in a first grade class and the string that we were using was for make a 10. Kids could beautifully make a 10 during number talks with that 9 and 6. So they're actually using the associative property there is what they're doing. But then not 10 minutes later, when we're done our warm up and we go into the core part of our math instruction, and I intentionally put a 9 and 6 into a story problem, kids would immediately go back to draw all count all. And I'd be like, what are you doing? Why aren't you using your number talk strategy? And it was at that moment and in and around there, and I'd been toying on it for a while, is we teach strategy void of context, which comes back to tasks. And so and then what happens is normally we say, let me teach you how to do the strategy and then go ahead and then solve the problem, which comes back to your initial question. So instead of saying, let me teach you the strategy and then go problem solve, it's I want to give you the problem and then I want to go ahead and the strategy will come from that. But if you think of the way resources are aligned, let's go with first grade, for example. Like Monday, we're going to do make a 10 and then we're going to talk about unicorns. Tuesday, we're going to do doubles and we're going to talk about soccer balls. Wednesday, we're going to talk about doubles plus one and we're going to talk about sandwiches. Every day is a different context. Every day is a different strategy. So because of that story in first grade, and I think in ELA, we do this beautifully, right? Like if you read You Give a Mouse a Cookie on Monday, every stinking thing that you do for the rest of the week talks about a mouse and a cookie, right? Right? Yes. That's that mentor text. But in math, every day is a different context. Every day is a different strategy. So student miss the connections. So what Tracy and I designed was the Building Fact Fluency Toolkit, where we only work with one singular strategy for an entire week. And it's done through a lesson string, which is a series of routines and activities that are purposefully connected. It's only one strategy and it's only one context. So if on Monday we do a 3-act task on apples, for the rest of the week, all we do is talk about apples and we only talk about doubles instead of jumping around. So in terms of coherence, context and strategy, that's kind of where that came about, to where the context is all grounded in images and videos, which resonates with students.
Yeah.
That was a mouthful.
No. But I think you bring up such a good point. I think sometimes we can overwhelm students with all of the new constantly. And I don't know how you feel about this. One of the things that I enjoy doing is using kind of like a problem frame. Essentially it is a like numberless word problem, but students are they're using that same context and they're using different sets of numbers within it. So they're not having to, this is especially helpful for like our multilingual learners. Mm-hmm. They're not having to read a new problem. They can still work in the math, and the context is there really to kind of like bring meaning to the numbers. So a little bit different than what you're talking about with this like rich task at the beginning, that we're using as like the start of a lesson, but maybe in a different situation, we're using kind of the same context over and over. So we're kind of like minimizing, we can focus a little bit more on whatever it is, the strategy that they're working with, and not so much on a brand new context every single time.
Yeah. No, I think they are quite similar, because I think in every classroom, there's this competing competition, and the fight that's happening is between the context of the problem and the quantities in the problem. So what happens is if every day we're changing the context and we're in an addition unit, kids don't give a toss about the context. They just grab the numbers and they just exactly. Go ahead and just add, right? But then what happens is if we keep the context the same, then kids can now grapple with the quantities. Mm-hmm. But when we give them both to them simultaneously, then they just take those numbers out. But yeah, I think that's a That's a great connection, like numberless word problems, because what you're doing is you're developing that context before the quantities are introduced. And that helps the sense making.
Yeah. And it also helps students realize that they bring knowledge to the table, because one of my favorite things to do with students is in this type of situation is to give them a problem like that. And it has like basic whole numbers in it. And then you put fractions in it before they know actually how to add fractions. And they realize that they can still get a solution. They have manipulatives, they can still solve it. And they're like, oh, addition has like, addition still behaves the same, even though we're now working with fractions. And so they get to see those connections there.
Yeah.
Which is just, it's so cool. I think it just highlights the connections.
I think it's kind of a soapbox that I've been stepping on here recently, and nowhere does it say that kids need to own 20 different strategies. But what we do is we teach 20 different strategies. But what ends up happening is that when every single strategy that we teach can fall under a property. So when you're talking about that reasoning between whole numbers and fractions, the numbers are changing, but the property is the same. So like, for instance, in first grade, in kindergarten, first grade, 9 plus 7 is make a 10. Well, when we get into second grade and we're adding 59 plus 7, that make a 10 is now called a benchmark number or a friendly number. Then when you get to fifth grade and you're adding 5 and 9 tenths plus 1 and 2 tenths, it's now called make a whole. So we have three totally different names for the exact same strategy, which is the associative property. Right. And so I think that's why kids, when we have numberless word problems, like the goal isn't to teach strategy. The goal is to teach numerical reasoning. So mm-hmm. when students are able to apply that whole number understanding to fractions, it's not a strategy, it's numerical reasoning. And that's through the properties. But yeah, that's kind of where my brain has been spending a lot of time here over the last couple months.
Okay. Can you give me another example of this? Because I'm so fascinated by this. And let me, while you're thinking about another example of this, it's, you know, we talk about this a lot. You know, I talk a lot about like upper elementary and this idea that we teach so many different strategies. And I will always say like, but it's really the same thinking. Like if you think about multiplying multi-digit numbers, like we are teaching, or students are supposed to be using the area model. And then it's the partial products or like the conceptual algorithm, because really all of it is basically partial products. And then we have the standard algorithm, which is still like, literally it's all the same thinking. So I've been saying this for so long. And so hearing you say like, oh, but they all fall on the same property, I feel like I need to hear another example, because I feel like maybe not exactly, but I feel like I'm and maybe starting to step on your same soapbox. Like I'm getting there.
Yeah. And so I think like, we'll take your fourth grade example with multiplication, just because you had mentioned that, where like in fourth grade, we call it like the four square, or we call it the breakup, or we call it partial products. Some people call it the area model. And at the end of the day, it's the distributive property. It's mm-hmm. the area model with partial products with using the distributive property. And so those are kind of those examples. Like numbers can be decomposed, factors can be decomposed into smaller parts to be multiplied and then put back together. So I think about this, one of the places where this was really eye-opening for me was when our daughter had to multiply 6 times 5/8. And so I was expecting, put the 6 over the 1, multiply straight across. But what she did was when she was multiplying 6 times 5/8, she said 6 times 4/8, 4/8 is 1/2. So 1/2 of 6 is 3. And then she said 6 times 1/8 is 6/8. So 6 times 5/8 is 3 and 6/8. And she was able to do that mentally. And what that showed is that she was leveraging the distributive property that she had built with whole numbers in third grade and fourth grade, and can now apply that to fractions as well. When we go ahead and we say, well, you can't multiply mixed numbers, you need to change them into an improper fraction and multiply. You can, you just decompose them using that area model. And the fact that you're smiling, you're like, yeah, I see it as well, right? Like whole number, fraction, whole, and it's the same thing.
Exactly.
And so those for me are the through lines. And nowhere in our standards does it say explicitly call out strategies. So again, this whole idea around progressions. The only place where strategies are explicitly called out is in first grade with make a 10 and doubles. every other place in most state standards, it says students will solve multiplication and division problems using their understanding of place value and properties. That's it.
Yeah.
So okay. that's now the North Star. The North Star isn't to teach strategy. The North Star is to teach numerical reasoning through the properties and place value.
Yeah. Okay. I am totally with you on this. I'm like, okay, I need to sit with this because I think this is a really big, I was trying to look for a better word than this is a really big deal, but it's a really big deal. Like, it's a big this deal. Is, yeah.
Because what I happens mean, is think about it. When we think about teachers and supporting teachers in the work, right? Like when I first got married, if the recipe book said 21 grains of salt, I'm going to put 21 grains of salt. I don't want to kill my wife or my girls. But over years, I don't even need that stink book. I mean, that stinking cookbook. But what ends up happening is when teachers, elementary teachers, are the cook, the grill master, the baker, then when they pick up that cookbook for math, it's just, I just got to teach the recipe, just teach the recipe. And the recipe has built this false dichotomy that kids need to own 20 different strategies.
Yeah.
And that's not the goal. So the more that we can zoom back out and see that progression of the through line isn't the strategy, the through line is the property, then that will free us up more time as well.
The through line isn't the strategy, the through line is the property. I am totally going to sit with that.
Great.
Because I feel like, you know, that there are certain things that you kind of like intuitively like sense and you don't yet know how to like fully explain it, or like, this is one of those things, like hearing you say that, it's like, I feel like I intuitively sense this, that we're breaking things apart that don't necessarily need to be broken apart. And so you're giving words to this thing that I have felt. So I appreciate you and thank you for that. I think that one of my biggest takeaways from our conversation is this idea of when to zoom in and when to zoom out. Like, I feel like that is something that you've talked quite a bit about, mm-hmm. yes, with these strategies, but then also thinking about, you know, working with students in the classroom and just where they're at, and then also looking at the lessons and zooming in and zooming out. And I think it just goes back to this fact that being a math teacher is both an art and a science. Like, we focus, I think, so much on the science of it, but it is such an art of making decisions of, you know, when to use this, this teacher move and when to zoom in and zoom out. And so I just really thank you for just bringing that to the podcast. And I think just giving teachers permission to trust themselves and look at the students in front of them and make decisions from there.
That's it. That's it. And I think with that pacing guide, it can seem really daunting to kind of squeeze it all in, but that pacing guide doesn't know you and your kids. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the day, we all step into the building every single day and we're advocating for the kids that we've been assigned to. And so we're just always trying to improve ourselves and to meet our kids wherever they are. And so I think that's it. And so continuing to listen to the podcast and continuing to invest in yourself and build that capacity, keeping teaching fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're going to link all of the places, but if I know teachers are going to want to connect with you. So where would you say is the best place for them to connect?
Probably just my website, gfletchy.com. So that would be it. You'll find tasks, you'll find the progressions there. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me through the contact form. That'll go right to my box and I'll shoot you back an email.
Awesome. Yeah. Before we started, I was like, we're going to try and make this 30 minutes, no. Like just long enough for a commute. And now we're sitting at 50 minutes, but thank you so, so much. I would absolutely love to chat with you again because you are just brilliant. Thank you so much for the work that you are doing and just putting out there for teachers and students. It is incredible.
And likewise, Brittany, thank you for sharing the message and continuing to just support teachers in their craft and the work that you do. It's a huge impact. So I appreciate the opportunity to kind of chat with you in this public space. I'm sure we'll have more chats at conferences. But yeah, thank you so much for all you do. I appreciate it.